we will hear arguments in Miranda versus Insurance Company of North America.
Okay, please report. Karen Murray, this is an argument on behalf of the petition.
Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report, I'm here today representing Miguel Miranda, petitioner. And through him, hopefully, the other workers' compensation claimants from the state of Texas. Texas law does not grant absolute immunity to workers' compensation carriers to engage in tortious conduct. The question is the extent of the duty of that workers' compensation carrier to the claimant through the adjusting of the workers' compensation claim. The question is whether or not that duty is one of ordinary care, the duty of good faith and fair dealing as articulated by this court in Arnold, the duty to consciously adjust the claim in good faith, whether that duty is one not to engage in willful or wanton conduct. There is a special relationship that exists between an injured worker and the compensation carrier, and it is probably the singularly most important special relationship that exists with an injured person in this state, because the workers' compensation claimant has, by statute, waived his right to sue his employer as a result of negligent acts that may have caused his injury. He has waived that right for a guarantee of benefit under the law, and when the compensation carrier acts outside of the law, and when that action outside of the law causes injury separate and apart from the injury that brought him forward as a claimant, then that compensation carrier needs to be held to a duty not to do so. Now, this court has already held that as a rule, insurance carriers can be held liable for extra contractual harm as a result of first-party occurrences. Certainly, the very first articulation of this principle goes all the way back to Stowers, and that has consistently been the law saying that the carrier could be held liable for extra contractual damages in the handling of a claim. In Marshall, this court went one step further and said the carrier can be held liable for not adhering to a judgment. In Arnold, you established a duty of fair dealing and good faith in handling a first-party claim. It is Mr. Aranda's contention that that duty of fair dealing should be extended to the claimant in workers' compensation context. Now, a carrier has argued throughout this case, both carriers involved, that the Compensation Act is an absolute bar, that is the sole remedy. And what the compensation carriers are in effect saying to this court is, we are different, we are separate, we are apart, do not hold us to the same duty you hold every other insurance company to in the state of Texas. That is not the law. And in fact, this court specifically stated in Marshall that the mere fact that Mr. Marshall was injured while working should not be used as a shield by the carrier to escape liability. If that is treated in the context of the judgment, then it is our contention it should also be treated in the context of a workers' compensation claim. And in this case, the facts are compelling in favor of Mr. Aranda.
Ms. Lerner?
Yes, sir.
In Arnold, the court found that there was a special relationship,
yes, sir,
between the insurance company and the insured because of exclusive control in evaluating the claim.
Yes, sir.
Here we have a buffer, the Industrial Accident Board. Can you speak to that, particularly the allegations that made in the brief, that this is different?
It is not different. In reality, there is no difference whatsoever between the investigation that is conducted by the insurance carrier and the determination that was made in Arnold, and the investigation that was conducted by both insurance companies and the determination. Somewhere in between there, there was a board award. But this matter, despite what was said in the briefs of the appellant, was not decided until a judgment was signed by the Honorable Lynn Hughes in the 189th Judicial District Court of Harris County. There was no difference. There was a conscious investigation by the comp carriers, and in fact, in INA's case, probably even more culpable because INA, through their investigation, initially determined the second employer. They knew that Unimineral was involved. They knew there was a second employer. They never brought that to the board's attention. They never said, we have a dispute. Here is the compensation benefit. We are paying them into the board as per the statute. They made a conscious decision. And in fact, the record in this case shows that their adjuster went to her supervisor and said, I've investigated this claim. This is a valid claim. What do you want me to do? And difference in the conduct that occurred in Arnold between that conduct on the part of INA in this case. It goes further. Once we went through the board proceeding, Lumberman sought and obtained the advice of their counsel. They have an office, certainly a law firm expert in the area of workers' compensation, who told that company, we can be held liable. You can be held liable for 100% of the damages. I suggest you pay the claim. They still continue to pay the claim, and in fact,
yes, so continue to deny to pay the claim.
Continue to deny to pay the claim until we finally got this matter into the courthouse. Mr. Randall was not agreed the disability determination by the board was fair, and he was not agreed by that decision, but he still did not get the money that the board awarded until after this matter was brought before the 189th Judicial District Court.
You mean a pre-hearing conference that did not resolve this claim?
There were two pre-hearing conferences on this claim, Your Honor. The first one was only with INA, at which point in time the board entered an interim order requiring INA to pay $1,000 immediately to Mr. Randall. They did comply with that interim order of the board. A second claim for compensation was then filed, because that was the first time that the evidence came before the board of the second comp here. The second claim was then filed against Lumberman, which resulted in a second pre-hearing conference and board award. That second award, final award of the board, had one half of medical expenses incurred and one half of the compensation disability benefits to be paid, assessing against each carrier. That award was appealed to the District Court of Harris County, Texas, and eventually resulted in a judgment by the 189th Judicial District Court.
Well, so I understand your position. You're not contending that the mere fact of appealing the board's award by a carrier some way breaches a duty of good faith and fair dealing, are you?
No, sir. In fact, I was at the board Monday on a case. And if I can distinguish a fact pattern, which is very real in workers' compensation, in that case, notice of injury was filed, the comp carrier initiated disability benefits, the comp carrier initiated medical benefits. But there is currently a dispute as to the nature and duration of the disability that my client sustained. It has gone to a board, the board will award it, and we will litigate the nature and extent. I haven't discussed it, I just got the award in, whether my client will appeal it or whether the carrier will appeal it. It's more than the carrier offers, so I send out an appeal from the carrier if I do not elect to appeal the board award. But I see no bad faith in that whatsoever, because there's a dispute in the medical testimony. And I would not in any way presume to say that breaches any duty owed by the carrier to litigate the nature and extent of the disability, because they consciously investigate the claim and are consciously paying the benefits, and there is a valid litigation dispute that exists on the disability. That is not the case of Mr. Randall. From day one, from the very first medical interview proceeds in this case, which is another fact of record in the transcript in this case, the doctor said, it's my opinion that his repetitious traumatic injury was caused by his job.
Alright, how long after the carriers had notice of the injury and claim for compensation elapsed before any payment was made to Aranda by either carrier?
It was over 6 months, and the $1,000 payment was the first payment made by any carrier. Mr. Aranda had been seeking to handle the claim for some time on his own and reached that point of financial deficit condition before he came to my office, and we then filed a hardship affidavit and compensated for a meeting pre-hearing conference, which Kerry got 30 days notice of that, so that, you know, had all the delay factors involved, and at that point in time, the interim award was there.
Are you saying it's during this 6 month period that the duty exists?
Yes, sir, I'm saying that, and then that also that period when it became obvious that there were two carriers involved, and up to and through the point in time that this matter was settled, that duty didn't just stop when they paid $1,000. The compact clearly makes a provision, which the carrier has a duty to adhere to pay the money to the board and let the board pay out and determine who owes to whom.
Right,
they continue to break the duty all the way through the process.
After the award of $1,000, were voluntary payments commenced by the carrier?
No, sir.
And
no time.
What weekly compensation benefit was in existence at the time of the injury?
I think it was $189 a week, but
we are talking roughly then about 5 weeks, $1,000 equaling 5 weeks, more or less.
Yes, sir, and it had been
approximately 6 months. 6 months is
okay. Yes, sir. And during this period, Mr. Lane sustained damages which were not the injury. And this is, I think, the key to the question. Mr. Aranda was forced to move as an adult back in with his parents because he could not pay his rent. His credit was totally destroyed, and a review of the credit records will show that it's the doctor, the hospital, the anesthesiologist, the bills incurred during the point in time that he had no money coming in and disability benefits. Mr. Aranda finally was released by his doctors, and he passed the physical and went to work, became a cadet in the Houston Police Department, and was requested he resign from the Houston Police Department because of his bad credit, because he is susceptible to a bribe, and one of the requirements of police departments, at least, or the one in Houston, is if you have an exemplary credit record and if you have no financial record. So he sustained ongoing continuing damages both at the time the carriers failed to make these payments, the damages that extended beyond that. He was working two jobs, I think this is in my plea, but he was working two jobs because he was trying to save money to go to college. And he had limited benefits and he needed more cash, so he was working a day job and a night job when the repetitious traumatic injury manifested itself. Because of the length of time we received no benefits, he had wages and no benefits. So we still have yet more damages that have accrued in this case that have nothing to do with the Compensation Act. These are damages because of a conscious decision on the part of the carrier to try to shift the responsibility to someone else.
You call it a conscious decision. Yes, are you claiming that this then is an intentional tort on the part of INA and Lumberman?
No. Yeah, well, let me say yes and no. I think it rises to the level of an intentional tort.
Well, if it does, then why didn't you mention Massey versus Stoneville in your brief?
It is cited at length in my brief in the Court of Appeals, but in a limited application for Rivera.
Doesn't Massey clearly hold that there's an intentional tort that you're entitled to a separate suit?
Yes, sir. I think so, but the Court of Appeals in its decision did not agree with the decision in Massey, nor did they extend their own reservation of a cause of action relating out of comp as stated in St. Paul versus McPitt. And in fact, I think there was no intentional tort cause of action in their opinion. I predicated my points of error in this case to look at that because I think if you're arraigned in any factual situation, I think that the conduct of the carrier rises to the level of intentional tort. But I think that the duty that exists with the compensation carrier is one of good faith and fair dealing, and a conscious decision not to act in good faith and not to deal fairly with an insurance claim. My husband, who is a lawyer, and I have philosophically argued this as to whether or not that duty is one of negligence or that is a duty slightly above the level of ordinary care. This court has in Arnold turned it to duty of good faith and fair dealing. And I see no reason, legally, morally, not to extend the language of Arnold to the adjusting of a workers' compensation claim at the board level.
I forget whether it was INA or Lumberman's in that brief, cited the board rule and said that you could have gotten a pre-hearing conference virtually immediately because they were not making voluntary comp payments. What is your reply to that?
I would ask the court to take judicial notice of the statistics of the Industrial Accident Board in Houston. I know the chair of the board is in chambers today. I will say that from my own personal experience, I had a pre-hearing conference that was requested 200 days ago on essentially the same fact situations. It was 187 days between the request and the notice of pre-hearing conference. The Houston office has some problems. There are volume problems that go beyond this. The rules are there, but the rules in many instances do not address the problem. And it still makes no difference whether or not I could or could not have gotten a pre-hearing conference immediately because Mr. Aranda sustained damages outside of the Compensation Act before he ever came to see me. He sustained damages when the carrier investigated the claim, determined his injury was compensable, determined he met every requirement of the contract, and didn't pay him a benefit. That's when he sustained damages, and he did not even come to my office for months after that occurred, trying to talk to his carrier because his employer had told him it's going to be taken care of by the comp carrier. And in fact, he was initially taken, the reason, the first point, by the way, was I was out of age, he was originally working. His name is Frank Pasquale, at work at AMST discussed
that they took him to the hospital, and it was his supervisor at that job, INA's insured, who then called the comp carrier and said, don't worry, the comp carrier will take care of it. So that was why there is a claim involved against INA, and he talked through his employer to get something. We don't know what's happening to give his compensation benefits, and it was months that passed. And damages, I thought, the compact that passed before we ever reached the point of an attorney's involvement or exercising or attempting to exercise the provision of the Workers' Compensation Act. That would have never happened if the compensation carrier had met its duty to the claimant, and it had not been done. The harm occurs when the carrier fails in the duty. The primary purpose of the compact is and always will be to protect injured employees at a time when they're having an economic emergency as a result of their injury. In Mr. Arena's case, he had bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome. His hands were swollen to the point that he could not feel or move them or do anything. His job required him to constantly use his hands. The withholding of the he was lucky in one regard. The doctor did not withhold medical treatment because the carrier did not pay bills. The doctor saw the emergency, and the doctor went ahead and treated him. And in fact, neither the doctors or the hospitals were ever paid until after the judgment was entered by the district court. But Mr. Aranda was lucky in that the doctor went ahead and treated him without that. But that is not always the case with the compensation carrier. With that failure to pay the weekly benefit, and with that failure, if there is a failure to pay the medical bill, a new harm occurs. A new harm is outside, distinct, and wholly separate from any obligation owed to the claimant of the contract. While the underlying cause of action arises in comp, this is a new injury, and it requires a duty and a means to compensate the claimant for the new injury that sustained. Now, effectively, the position of my opponents in this is that we want immunity from the responsibility to the Companies Act on our part, and we want this immunity to be given under the Workers' Compensation Act. We want immunity, and we don't care that you have imposed a duty on every other insurance company in the state. Comp is included the remedy of the claimant, and if we constantly deny a valid claim, they have to be put on a pedestal and given a special relationship that should not exist. They ask you to disregard fraud. They ask you to disregard malice. They ask you to disregard wanton, disregard for the rights of claimants. They ask you to disregard any act that they did wrong. Somewhere along the line, they pay disability and medical benefits. There is a duty, and that duty is for them to act in a manner so as not to breach good faith and fair dealing, to litigate valid contested comp cases, but when investigation, as in this case shows, to litigate contested comp cases, but when the investigation in this case shows that it is a valid, compensable, repetitious traumatic injury covered by the act, the pay benefits timely, in the manner contemplated. And if they do not do so, then they should be held to suffer the consequences of the damage that goes on.
And Arnold, we said we were recognizing the concept of good faith and fair dealing in first party insurance cases. But in doing so, we recognized Justice Spears' concurring opinion in English versus Fisher and said that we were doing it on the nature of the special relationship between an insurer and its insurance company.
Yes, sir.
Special relationship, therefore, is one of the factors in good faith and fair dealing. What is the special relationship between Aranda and these insurance companies?
The employer, Mr. Aranda, AMST has in Unum will purchase a policy of insurance to protect their employees. I think by that policy of insurance, that special relationship was created. the beneficiary of the policy are both the employer and the employee. The employer, by buying that policy of workers' compensation insurance, protects himself from a common law cause of action for negligence. The employee is guaranteed benefits. The carrier agrees to pay the benefits that the act sets out, and that creates the relationship, in my belief, between the employee and the workers' compensation carrier. To say that because someone else buys the policy, that that special relationship that exists in Arnold doesn't exist in comp, does not deal in the reality of the situation. In most instances, and I can afford to file the first report, the employer first report of injury on an injured employee, knows that the employer has almost nothing to do with what happens after that employer first report of injury. The entire adjusting, the entire relationship between employment and his injury is in the hands of the workers' compensation carrier. And only in those instances where the policy is what is called a retro policy that eventually will come out of the employer's pocket, does the employer in reality have anything to do with what goes on in that claim. The relationship is totally between the employee and the carrier. And a special relationship exists because you have somebody who is hurt. In most instances, the weekly disability benefits are far below what their weekly salary is. They have no income coming in. They have a lag time of usually 21 days before their first disability happens because of the 14-day period that you have to be off before you're going to start accruing benefits under the Act. They are totally vulnerable to whatever the carrier decides they're going to do. And they have no immediate recourse for the injuries that occur during that period of absolute vulnerability. Thank you, Alderman.
May it please the court, Mr. Jones Bison will speak on behalf of INA. He will speak for 15 minutes. Also, Mr. Royal Brent is not will be speaking on behalf of Lumberman. He will be speaking second on the 15 minutes.
May it please the court. I don't know at this point if we're outside the record or not from the comments made by the appellant in this case, but I think, first of all, I should point out what I consider to be some inaccuracies with what you stated as a factual basis to this case. First of all, a small point, we're talking about $154 a week case, not $189 for this case, I think the record will show. If you review the record, you will find that the first notice of any type of injury came in the first part of April of 1982. The $1,000 advance that was spoken of was not 6 months later. It was in June 15th of 1982. It was not ordered by the pre-hearing conference. I believe the record will show that it was a voluntary advance made by my client, INA, in this case at the pre-hearing conference. Also, it stated that the record would challenge that INA's adjuster carried or supervisor recommendations that this case was convinced one should be paid and the supervisor said no. I don't think the record reflects that at all. I think it reflects that there was a showing that there were two carriers involved. The degree and amount that those two carriers should pay was in dispute. In fact, in the record, INA supervisor at some point said that the job was more strenuous for the other employer, and therefore Lumberman should pay the claim. I don't know what Lumberman's concept was. I would assume they would say that, well, they worked more with INA. In any case, the point I bring forward to you is that there's a bona fide and was a bona fide dispute at the time this case arose. Now, we have a comp system that has been before the law in this state since 1917, I believe, 70 years now, slightly less than that when this case arose. But in any case, that law set out a system, and a complicated system, and a system that we pay a lot of people a lot of money to carry forward. That is to dispute claims between the various parties. Now, if this is not a claim
I don't know what it is.
Counsel, who is the dispute between?
The dispute at this point was between the carriers.
Not between the claimant and the carriers, but between the carriers.
Yes, sir, I would concede that.
And so for each carrier to litigate his dispute for the other carrier, the way he sought to do that was just to deny benefits to the claimant. Again, until they have no dispute.
Your Honor, I would offer...
Is that correct?
In most respects, yes, that is correct, Your Honor. It's also a fact that there is no method by which the dispute between the two carriers could be brought to the head or carried out or adjudicated without bringing it to what the system called and required to be done, and that is adjudication before the board. What the plaintiff would have this court impose is an extra system jurisdiction or adjudication process to be done by the individuals. You take it out of a system whereby you have a dispute resolution as well provided for in the statute and make it the responsibility of the claims adjuster alone to decide what is to be done, whether it's fair and right. And once he does that, if he's wrong, then you get an extra bite at the cherry. That is what the plaintiff wants. That extra bite. In this particular case,
what she's saying is, though, that why should the claimant pay for the price of a dispute between the two carriers? The claimant wasn't at fault. The act was to provide reasonable but prompt relief. And two carriers are disputing between each other. Yep. And the claimant's not even involved.
The flip side of that, Your Honor, is why should the other side of the party, the insurance companies, pay more than they're doing when there is a system provided by which this can be resolved and resolved in short order? That goes back to another factual basis that I think was misstated. If there was any hardship affidavit filed to press this thing to an early issue because of the damages she was claiming her client was suffering, I could not find it in the record. That is a process that is provided for in the statute that the claimant comes before the court, comes before the board and says, I need an immediate adjudication of this within 20 days and files an affidavit. I don't think that was done in this case. So there was a question on that specific issue by Justice Kilgarland, the plaintiff attorney, who said that in her experience it takes however long it is. I didn't hear her say that was under the same process where a hardship affidavit was filed. She said she asked for pre-hearing documents and it took a long time. The statute says it should be done in a specified time. It's very narrow.
Of course, all we are arguing here right now are facts, and I don't think anybody on this court is presupposing that you will lack in good faith, so that's a jury question. To me, the issue is whether or not we'll extend the concept of good faith and fair dealing to workers' compensation claims. Do you perceive that to be the issue?
Well, I do, Your Honor, if you get past the fact that she did not exhaust her administrative remedies, which I say is a more narrow fact, or more narrow concept that the plaintiff was first to hold. She didn't take care of what she could have done.
You have cited some board rules there and said she didn't exhaust her remedies, but one rule you didn't cite was Industrial Accident Board Rule 6185, which in speaking of pre-hearing conferences being important to the functioning of the system, says this necessarily includes a good faith effort on the part of both claimant or his or her attorney and of the carrier to negotiate in good faith. So don't the rules of the board themselves impose upon you the duty to negotiate in good faith?
I haven't reached that point, Your Honor.
Well, it's Board Rule 61.85. Perhaps you'd like to look at it and then maybe file something after.
I may well do that, Your Honor, but if there is, and I assume there is, a duty to act in good faith, what I'm pointing out to the court is that the board rules themselves take that into account, and the procedures for taking care of that, if it is not done, is present at the board level itself. There are remedies for that. As I pointed out in my brief, there are penalties that if the carriers do not do certain acts that go directly to the plaintiff in the case, and there are ways that they can press the issue to a hearing before the board at all times. So you don't have to go outside the board. Why go outside the board when the rules are there before the board to take care of the very problems that the plaintiff claims in this case? I would go further than that in this particular case to say that the plaintiff didn't even avail himself of the rules that were in existence. Yet now he wants to go outside of that particular process.
Are there board rules to cover a situation such as this where there's a dispute between two carriers as to who is responsible for what percentage of the weekly comp and medical expenses occurred to the claimant? Is there an orderly board process to determine that?
The pre-hearing conference is the hearing officer takes care of that and decides on hearing the parties present what has occurred. The relationship is and who is responsible for the injury.
And the hearing examiner can then make a temporary award as to who paid what portion of weekly comp plus medical expense?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my understanding.
Was that done in this case?
It ultimately was done, yes, sir.
As for how long?
The pre-hearing conference was in June, as I indicated before, and it was a formal hearing in August, early August, August 6th or something like that, 1982.
Was it done in June, or was a formal hearing in August required before comp payments were initiated?
Comp was never initiated. There was a compromise settlement agreement entered into in August. Actually, the case was only appealed, as the plaintiff has correctly noted. Only because of the mechanical aspects of getting the CSA signed in August. It was then appealed because of the time limit was running in. At that point in time, the agreement was carried forward.
As a practical matter, don't insurance companies have arbitration agreements and coverage disputes exist between two carriers? They arbitrate those.
In some instances, it's my knowledge that they did. In this particular instance, I'm not aware. And comp generally, I'm not aware whether there are arbitration agreements involved.
You said earlier, when you first stood up, that April the claim was made, and in June, voluntary payments commenced.
No, not voluntary payments, Your Honor. A voluntary
advance
of $1,000 was made.
Was that made at the time of the pre-hearing conference?
Yes, it was, sir. In June.
So no payment was made until the pre-hearing conference was held.
That is not a candidate.
And no payment was made after that until the compromise settlement agreement.
Until that process was in place, yes, Your Honor. Ultimately, no payment was made because it was held up then because of the paperwork until January of the following year. But I must say that that process was not at the instance of the insurance company.
So whatever Ms. Lerner was negligent in getting a pre-hearing conference set or not is really immaterial, because once she got her conference, there still wasn't the commencing of the comp payments.
Well, there was the advance, Your Honor.
It was that advance she owed for about 6 weeks, and it's $154.
Were weekly payments ordered in the preliminary hearing board?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Was a judgment made at the pre-hearing conference that both insurance companies were liable and they were to pay each half?
I think that was entered in the formal hearing in August.
And then no payments were made even after that hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. An agreement was reached, a settlement was reached at that point in time. In fact, what
the settlement between who?
The insurance companies would pay as ordered. But the paperwork could not be completed.
From June until January?
Well, that was because the plaintiff attorney insisted upon other language in the settlement document. That's my understanding. Nowhere outside the record.
No, it's staying in the record. I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, what, how much of the facts you can agree on. You know, because if a settlement was made between the insurance company and the claimant, and then there was a dispute as to language, and it took 6 months or more to resolve that dispute, and even then, no payments were made until the district court intervened, is that what happened?
The district court didn't intervene. Your Honor, I think that it was carried to the district court because the time required to be done in that fashion, because the agreement could not be put into writing in time for the appeal process to be necessary to begin.
There's something unseemly about two insurance companies who admit that a worker had been injured and the claim is due, and they just can't decide who's to pay the bill. In the meantime, all the worker gets is $1,000, and there's certain consequence that flow from that, as you described, about losing a job, bad credit rating, having to move his parents, being booted out of the academy. You know, these are egregious facts that you serve up to us, and then you, you know, we get some opinion as a result of these bad facts.
Well, Your Honor, I was opposed to the court that they're not egregious facts, but it was a dispute that must be resolved in some fashion, and the system itself presented a fashion that it was to be resolved in, and we availed ourselves of the system that was in place rather than going outside of the system.
Who was the dispute between?
The dispute was between the carrier and the claimant as to when and who and what job caused the injury that was complained of.
Wasn't a dispute between the two carriers as to who was going to pay how much?
It was to decide, Your Honor, yes, to that extent. It was to decide who was to pay and how much was to be paid.
Then why didn't one of the carriers sue the other carrier to resolve that dispute between them without holding the claimant hostage?
We did, Your Honor. We did it in the board. That is where you do that. The board resolved those issues.
What happens to the claimant during a 6 month period of time when nothing is coming in? You got to put groceries on the table. You know, I mean, is he to be a victim of this?
Well, Your Honor, you have to go forward with the rules as they exist that are laid out by the legislature to take care of this. You can ask the claimant can ask for an expedited hearing, which he did not do, to resolve this.
They got a hearing. It still went 6 months after that.
Well, Your Honor, that is not entirely because of the insurance company.
In 1930,
the insurance company wanted and tried to pay the judgment as soon as the formal board hearing was rendered. It was not at our instance, but it was not done at that point in time.
In 1936, this court said in PEIA versus Wright that the purpose of the compensation law is to provide speedy, equitable relief to an employee injured in the course of his employment.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
You're saying 6 months is
done in this case?
Well, Your Honor, would you say that the insurance company should go outside of the boardroom? What direction does an insurance company have at that point in time, if you're saying? Don't pay attention to the board rules. Don't do it by what the law says you should do. You should take some other extra precaution to get these things done.
It's called rolling the dice. When you refuse to pay a claim on a comp claim, saying we don't have any coverage, isn't it? You know what it amounts to?
We didn't say we didn't have any coverage. We presented the dispute to the agency that was charged with resolving that. In just the way it was supposed to be. What the plaintiff would, or the appellant's case would have us do is do something extra, something more, something different, and make up those rules as we go.
Well, what was the controversy on the wording of this compromise settlement agreement that prolonged this for 6 months?
Well, as I understand it, and I was not doing it myself, I'm only reading what was done, it was not entered within the mails because it had to go to the various parties. It did not get back to the court, or if it did not get entered by the House, I think it was the board. It didn't get entered with the board. Therefore, it was then taken to district court. Releases and judgments were circulated. At that point in time, it was discovered that the plaintiff had filed this particular lawsuit that we are talking about here without even noticing anybody, or maybe it was not even brought up. But in any case, the wording would have precluded this lawsuit in the releases, and she wanted to take that out, and more judgments were circulated and so forth, and that's what took out here.
Thank you.
Your life.
Thank you. Please, Court, Justice Kilgore has mentioned the Master case, and I think that case is very pertinent here. It's true that that case recognizes that that may be in a compensation situation an action or intentional wrong. But also, what the court had before in that case and specifically ruled on was told that there could be no common law action or a conspiracy between the employer and the compensation carrier to resist a compensation claim. And the reason there could not is because there was no independent part action against the carrier merely for not paying or settling the claim. If that were wrongful, then a conspiracy to do something that's wrongful, of course, would be actionable too. And I have, in the last few days, gotten together some additional cases on duty question, but if the court will permit, I won't take time from the oral argument to cite all those, but I'd like to put those as soon as I get home into letter form, circulate them and talk today on a somewhat different point.
How much time would you need, counsel, please?
Well, certainly I get it on the way in the next couple of days, and should be here this week.
Okay, and you'd be, what, 10 days for time?
Your Honor, that would be appreciated if I'm going to trial.
Thank you. Be allowed.
Mr. Brennan, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Does the company you represent agree with the representation that had been made that you made a judgment that this was a valid claim and your company was liable?
No,
the
sir.
Only dispute is between two insurance companies.
No, sir.
All right, tell it.
First, the next thing I wanted to say was I do not agree that this was purely a dispute between insurance companies.
Well, this is your best shot. You know, give us your best effort because...
I said a number of them had a dispute with Iran because it isn't just a situation of how much. We're both liable. How much did each one pay? There was good basis for lumbermen's to take the position that it had no liability at all. And that leads into this proposition that even if there can be a cause of action for a bad faith denial or enough delay of a compensation cause, that such a cause of action could not exist under the pleadings here. And those are pleadings which this petitioner refused to amend. And that petitioner's own pleading and even their own application for writ of error negate this charge of bad faith. Now, what is pleaded in the fourth amended petition, and that was the operative pleading of the plaintiff, is that Grant was entitled to recover compensation either from Lumbermans or from INA or for both. So there you have Grant's own petition saying, well, I don't know who I'm entitled to recover from. I'm entitled to recover from somebody. It might be one, it might be the other, it might be both. Now, as it happened, the board eventually determined it was both. But initially, that was not determined. Nor was it even alleged that Lumberman knew that both were liable or that it was liable. Plaintiff's own application for writ of error in this court states that both carriers investigated the claims and determined that the injuries were the result of plaintiff's work. And this is the plaintiff's own words in the application at either or both of his employers. Now, if it was both, Lumbermans would have liability. If it was Union Mineral alone, Lumbermans insured, it would have liability. But if it was Tumascope, then Lumbermans would have no liability whatsoever. And any liability that existed would be on the part of INA. And there can only be bad faith if you know you owe some money and refuse to pay it. And plaintiff's own allegations here are only that they knew they might or might not owe some money. And plaintiff was given the opportunity to amend those allegations and refused to do so. So the main argument I wish to make is that this is not an appropriate case to establish a duty of good faith and fair dealing on the part of a compensation carrier, because if there is such a duty, it does not exist under the pleadings in this case, and plaintiff refused to amend those pleadings. The Curry opinion in Arnold sets forth the requirements for that general duty as in first party insurance cases in general.
One admonition, Mr. Brand, if you note that opinion, that is my opinion, is what the elements are, and that does not mean to imply that the court shares my view.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
But I find nothing in the opinion, in the main opinion in this case, that would indicate any
disagreement with the requirement that you had for.
Do you think that the majority in Illinois wanted to adopt the requirements of Justice Gonzalez suggested that they might have put it in the majority opinion?
I don't think we can conclude that there was disagreement with them. The impression I get is that the rest of the court did not at that time also have spelled out requirements. What?
Two of the requirements. Well, one requirement,
there might be some question about all of those requirements being the requirements, but there's one of them I think it has to be in question. And that's one of them.
That is.
In my view, and that is that
the insurer either has knowledge
that
it has no reasonable basis for denying the claim, or fails to determine whether there is any reasonable basis to deny the claim. I don't see how anyone can dispute that requirement, that there must be one or the other of those
situations. Now, again, here, the plaintiff's own allegations establish that they had
no failure to determine whether there was a
reasonable basis, but they did make a determination, but that determination was only that there was an injury either arising from the employment of one employer or the other, or both,
but there was no failure to investigate, and as you go on, there was the determination when it has to get money, still result in, according to Plaintiff's own allegations, that indefiniteness, whether there was or was not liability on the part of, from our point of view, loans. Therefore, there was neither a failure to investigate nor the absence of a reasonable basis for denying the claim. Mother, I had some comment inquired as to distinguishing this case from Edna Marshall. It is a combination case, but there, wrongdoing was after there was a final judgment, and the case had gone through the board and the court, and the carrier refused or failed to comply with the final judgment. Whereas here, the claim of the plaintiff is that this wrongdoing took place even before she ever saw Aranda, yeah, and before the claim was on the board.
Of course,
you claim against INA first, but it wasn't until later.
Then that language in the application, which I quoted in our supplemental brief, would be to withdraw the writ as improvidently granted. And in a more proper case, decide the fundamental issue of whether there is or is not a duty of good faith on the part of a compensation carrier. And while the case is still within the compensation procedures prescribed by the Act. Thanks.
I think there's a little bit of confusion in the court as to the chronology of answers. Since I am the only party who started with this process and is still with this process, I would like to clarify that for the court. When Mr. Randa came to me, the initial letter that went to the Industrial Accident Board was, the claimant is not receiving compensation. Please set this matter for immediate pre-hearing conference. The hardship affidavit requires when no compensation is being paid.
Would you tell us when you're going off the record? I prefer
this is a record in the board file.
Well, because you know we got it by the record, and there's been an allegation made that you went outside the record, and we.
No, sir.
I like to know for my benefit.
No,
I'm sure the board would too.
This is a record right. In that it is stated in plaintiff's pleadings, which is assumed as factual for the purposes of this appeal, since this matter has come up by way of the pleadings being stricken. The original claim to the board, the original request for a pre-hearing conference, was based upon no compensation being paid, no hardship affidavit is required. Hardship affidavit is, as a matter of board rules, designed when the expenses exceed the amount of the weekly compensation benefit. It is not required by board rules to get a pre-hearing conference if there is no comp being paid. At the pre-hearing conference, whether a formal...
What was the date of that letter?
Your Honor, without going back and looking at my file prior, I could not tell you. At the pre-hearing conference, there was no formal order entered. To pay the $1,000. Ms. Jan Kelly was the pre-hearing officer on the case, and she turned to INA and she said, I want you to pay him $1,000 right now. And INA wrote the check that day. There was no formal interim order entered by the board, but when the pre-hearing officer, resident reviewer, tells you to pay it, had it not been done, there would have been an interim order. The case,
now, which
then
hearing
the pre-hearing conference
about?
Was recessed at the request of the pre-hearing officer.
Which hearing are you talking about where this $1,000 was ordered? That was in June?
I did not go back and review the dates, Your Honor. I can give you a chronology from the board file in my supplement, which gives you all the specific dates, notice letter to the board and all of that, because that is at my office. I did not bring that portion of the file with me in this case. But that is before the court as part of the transcript. From the trial court record, all of those documents are contained in the transcript of the case.
Do I understand there were two hearings?
Yes, sir.
One earlier and then in August, an order for the $1,000 to be paid?
No, sir. first pre-hearing conference conducted only with a representative of INO with an order for $1,000 to be paid. It was paid on that day.
That's what he said was June.
I can't tell you the date. Second pre-hearing conference, INO and Lumberman both in attendance. Lumberman was represented by Clay Hive in August. Board of pre-hearing conference recommendation for a board award was entered at that point in time against both carriers. That went to formal hearing before the Industrial Accident Board in August, if their dates are correct. The formal award of the board was appealed pursuant to board rules because the carriers couldn't get their act together and get a check to. That was appealed to the 189th Judicial District Court, and there was some delay involved because the original judgment is prepared by the attorney for INA, stated any and all claims arising out of comp, and this attorney insisted that the judgment reflect that the settlement was only for disability and medical benefits arising out of a compensable injury.
Who appealed the comp case from the board to the court?
I think both parties appealed, Your Honor. It was consolidated into the 189th, and I don't know whether that was my petition or INA's petition or Lumberman's petition, but I think Justice Mosby that both parties did appeal because the carrier could not get a check issued from, you know, from time of the award through the time of the formal hearing, and there was only 20 days in which to appeal the board award, and nobody really knew what was happening at this point in time.
Well, what did they do that they were not entitled to do under the board rules?
All right, first thing, in the statute, the specific citation is cited in my supplemental application for writ of error. There is a specific statute within the compact. There's a dispute among the carriers that paid money to the board. That's number one. If there's a dispute as to which carrier owes the benefit, they paid money to the board, they asked for the board to make the determination, and the board pays the claim.
Well, now Mr. Brin just said there was a legitimate dispute as to whether Lumberman's owed anything.
Well, not according to their counsel, and their counsel's letter is a record in the transcript in this case, wherein their counsel said, you owe it, pay it.
When did that occur?
It occurred at least at the time of the pre-hearing conference, but their adjusting file is also a record. And their adjuster investigated the claim, and their adjuster also made a determination that it was compensable. And that occurred prior to the pre-hearing conference. And the I would agree with Mr. Guyton on this, Justice Wallace, that the dispute was which carrier owed how much, not whether which carrier owed anything. And consistently throughout the adjusting files on this claim, which are a record in this case, the dispute was who owed how much, not whether anybody owed money. And both carriers attempted to foist the liability for the letter, if I recall the context, and I read it about a week ago, was you could, the Lumberman's attorney, Clay Hive in August, saying you could be liable for 100% of it, why don't you try to compromise it by paying 25%?
Ms. Lerner?
Yes, sir.
We're here because your pleadings were stricken.
Yes, sir.
On the grounds that they did not state a cause of action.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Brin has argued that on the very face of your pleadings, you don't state a cause of action of bad faith because you say either Lumberman or INA or both.
Yes,
and that on its face pours you out of court on a bad faith claim.
I disagree with him, and I'll call the court's attention specifically to the provisions of Article 8309, which is the repetitious traumatic injury statute. And I would also call the court's attention to PEIA versus Page, an opinion by Justice Daniel of this court at 553-2-98, wherein it is made clear that the carrier is responsible for the payment of compensation benefits for a repetitious traumatic injury where it manifests itself to the point that the employee can no longer work. Both carriers were liable for 100% of it on the day Mr. Aranda couldn't work. They didn't have to investigate it. They didn't have to apportion it. What my pleading states is I could have gone after either or both of them. Not that there was a dispute as to which one of them owed it, but I could have gotten 100% from one and made the other one go see the other carrier. That does not fail to state a cause of action. Both Mr. Aranda was making above average weekly wage for both employers on the day his injury manifested itself to the point that he could no longer work.
This didn't depend on who, what employer?
No, sir. No, sir, it does not depend on one employer. And the statute was specifically written in that regard because of the problem of primarily of the inhalation tort, where an individual could have inhaled, say, asbestos particles for 5 employers over multiple years and multiple crop years. So the statute by its express terms, Article 8309 says, if the employer where the injury manifests itself to the point that he can no longer work, it doesn't make any difference who caused it. And that's where Mr. Brand's argument fails. It fails by the express provisions of the repetitious traumatic statute. It's not who caused it, it's where the employee can no longer work. That's the issue, and that's what is clearly stated in the statute, NCEIA versus Page, and the case is stated in Petitioner's brief, which also says the date of the cumulative injury. The date the injury caused him to lose employment. So that's where liability arises. It was claimant's hope that by bringing in the second carrier we could resolve matters, because INS explained we don't know it. So we brought in the second carrier. And we said, we don't care who pays it. Somebody owes it. It's the day the injury manifested itself to the point that Mr. Aranda can no longer work. And both of them said, me no alimony, and pointed their fingers in that direction. They said, we don't know what the other guy does, when they both owed 100% of it, and the dispute was between them, not between the claimant. The statute requires the carrier to pay the claimant for the benefits when and as accrued. The claimant took advantage of the board rules as they existed and the procedures as they existed, elected to file a case along with the carrier to appeal it, and ultimately the matter was settled by judgment. The carrier failed in express statutory requirement to pay the benefits relating from the manifestation of the repetitious traumatic injury. If this does not allow the claimant to recover for the damages for the breach of their express statutory duty, then more claimants will suffer the effect that Mr. Aranda suffers because of the compensation carrier being placed on pedestal above the law.
Thank all counsel. That concludes the business report from March 48.